Support for this podcast comes from 1440 Multiversity. Enjoy a buffet of modalities from daily yoga and meditation to nourishing seasonal meals and access to holistic spa services at the Healing Arts Center. Learn more at 1440.org/beherenow.
Welcome to the Road Home Podcast with Ethan Nickturn. Join Ethan as he and his guests explore the Buddhist path as it relates to art, culture, activism, politics, Western psychology, and more. If you'd like to support Ethan's podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Ethan.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Road Home Podcast. This is Ethan Nickturn, and I'm really honored to be here with Dharma teacher and coach and author Ruth King, whose most recent book is Mindful of Race, Transforming Racism from the Inside Out, somebody I've wanted to have on the podcast for a while. So, Ruth, thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ethan.
So usually, I don't know if it's boring to people who listen to this, but I find it always interesting that usually when it's a Dharma person or somebody who's really deeply steeped in mindfulness and meditation, I usually ask the person to share a little bit about their origin story, how you got into meditation practice or studying Buddhism, et cetera. So,
yeah, well, I can speak a little bit about that. It's funny, and I always enjoy the stories of how people come into any kind of contemplative practice. But I was actually in China at the Women's World Conference in Beijing and met a woman, a black woman who, we were both standing there staring at a 2 or 3 story golden Buddha. And we had tears streaming down our eyes. And it just so happened this woman was on the board of Spirit Rock in California and invited me to come and meditate with her. And at the time I was kind of considering that, but then here was this opportunity to really walk in. So I went with her, and while I had done some reading about Buddhism, that night was a talk by her teacher, Jack Kornfield, who later became my teacher. But he said some very significant things that really turned my head around in terms of a spiritual practice. He offered the teachings by saying that you should know for yourself what these teachings are really about. Don't take my word for it. And there was something about hearing that invocation, if you will, of don't take my word for the teachings. Know for yourself through your own practice, through your own direct experience. So this was in the late 80s, early 90s. And after I went with Dr. Marlene Jones Schoonover is who her name was, who's now passed away. I had been studying with Spirit Rock and the Spirit Rock community, or the Spirit Rock tradition, if you will, since that time. And also began to explore the Dzogchen Tibetan Shambhala teachings for about 8 years. I worked with a teacher in that tradition for a while, really looking at the non-dual teachings. But my heart is really in the Theravada tradition because of the instructions around insight meditation. So I'm on the teacher's council there at Spirit Rock, and also on the teacher's council at Insight Meditation Community of Washington, where I teach and work with dedicated practitioners who really want to understand the bones of the Buddha's teachings and how that relates to their day-to-day lives.
So thank you so much for that. And I just want to talk maybe a little bit about your book, even though it's not a super new book, but it's a newish book, and I have found it such a great resource. I have to say, I really found that your book is so steeped in kind of pedagogical and teaching frameworks that it feels really actionable in terms of how to kind of blend, you know, Dharma teachings and mindfulness teachings with an awareness of race and racism. So Can you talk a little bit about how this particular book came about? What made you decide to write it, or how it evolved?
Yes. Well, my background is in organizational development and leadership development, with working inside of corporate America around culture change, especially back in the day when there was a lot of mergers and acquisitions happening in the Silicon Valley. So there was all this explosion of cultures being thrown together. And it was traumatic, to say the least, because, you know, that's how it is when you mix cultures. So I was very supportive in just helping leaders understand the merge of that. And it was actually around this time that I went to China that I was kind of retiring from my corporate life and moving more into mindfulness practice or insight practices. And it was right around that time that I realized that I was, you know, not really leaving that world behind, but I was continuing to enter it as I moved into these insight meditation communities. These spiritual communities had similar challenges to their cultural habitation, if you will, or their cultural conditioning, particularly around diversity and race, and how that was actually living in our spiritual community. So Dr. Jones, who invited me into Spirit Rock, was also on the board of Spirit Rock. And she asked me if I would support Spirit Rock in looking at some of the diversity issues. I joined the Diversity Council. And what I found was that there was still, you know, race and racism is still like the kind of a groove of distress that's throughout our society. And what I saw, after a while at least, was an opportunity to blend my professional background in organizational development and my personal history around racial conditioning and teaching race training inside of corporate life and nonprofits, by the way, with my spiritual practice, which was steeped in mindfulness and investigating the territory of distress and numbness that I lived with and I saw others living with, and how mindfulness practice or Buddhist practice, because, you know, given that the Buddha specialized in suffering, you know, here's a suffering for real, right? Racism. So how might the teachings really support our understanding of our conditioning and response to the racial distress within ourselves and within the world? So it made a lot of sense to me, because I was, my professional background taught me how to design trainings, that I would integrate these two streams steeped in my own personal experience and my own life as a 71-year-old woman here in America, a Black woman, lesbian woman in America, how these streams would come together and give birth to some strategies or skillful means for working with this on a day-to-day, breath-to-breath, step-to-step kind of way.
So, I mean, maybe this is too hypothetical a question, but, you know, it is of interest to me and kind of sadness, you know, being in, I've studied different Buddhist traditions, but predominantly in the Shambhala and other Tibetan traditions. And I grew up in that tradition and definitely noticed that historically, at least, I won't say this universally, but many of the meditation communities in the West, you know, were really, really predominantly white. And it was in fact, in a lot of cases, you know, the Dharma spaces I entered were some of the least diverse spaces that I entered, which always confused me that it would be so predominantly white, in the sense that it's, you know, it's an Asian cultural heritage. You know, some of these teachings came out in Western culture in the 60s, 70s, at the same time as the civil rights movement was happening. So do you have any thoughts other than just, you know, the overarching structure of how white-centric American society has been, on why historically many of these mindfulness or Dharma spaces were so predominantly white?
Well, I don't think we can separate, you know, this kind of Western the pervasiveness of racism that is foundational to this country is not distinct from spiritual communities. So in some ways, it's kind of like, of course, of course, we're going to see that. We're going to see racism in not just society, but in spiritual communities as well. I think where this is a big question, but I'll just take a few threads from it. One is that the Buddha teaches us about the three jewels, which are Dharma, our Buddha, our Buddha nature, Dharma, the teachings, and Sangha, the community. And I think what happened largely in our traditions, not just in Insight or Buddhist communities, but in churches in general and other gatherings is, the consciousness of the leadership is going to replicate the community. It's going to replicate what the Sangha looks like. And, a lot of the teachers that came back, the white teachers, Jewish teachers, came back from Asia and began to create communities here of practice, contemplative mindfulness practice. They brought their consciousness here with them. And so what that then magnifies are the gravitational pull that comes in is the consciousness of the leader. That's what gets replicated. But I think we gravitate toward what ended up in my mind being lacking is the whole cultural context of the West. The reality is that there's a lot of racism in this country. So it gets replicated. The racial piece that most people of color I know are in need of is a real sense of feeling connected and belonging. So it makes sense to me that there would be separation in these communities because that third jewel of Sangha in terms of diversity within, the West here hasn't really been cultivated. It's not really reflected oftentimes in our spiritual communities. I think that along with the communities being, not only are they kind of Euro kind of centric, I think that there's a, there's the whole thing around having the time and privilege to go away on retreat, to be contemplative. The teachings of turning inward when is a little challenging for a lot of people of color that are really dealing with the complexities in their day-to-day lives, and the weight of that, the weight of dealing with racism when we are in mixed groups and the unconsciousness of people. So in general, I think the separation is just a river that's been flowing, and then it gets then we get to see it a little more intimately when we come into these contemplative practices if we're willing to look at that. So this is a big question. I don't know if I'm really answering it. But another thing I can say about this is I don't think the measure, I don't think it's necessarily a problem if if our sanghas are predominantly white. What I'm most interested in is their consciousness around whiteness? Is their consciousness around racism? Are our teachers and leaders understanding, how this gets embodied and the power of their role to work with the practice and to demonstrate ways of this, of investigating race and racism in that teacher's seat. And I think that's what begins to shift and pull in a different kind of demographic, perhaps, because there's a consciousness around what people of color, for example, are walking with in the world and how that gets reflected and offered and as context as we sit and do this practice, that there's sensitivity to that by the teacher, whoever the race is. So those are some of the things I get concerned about. If a sangha is diverse or not doesn't matter to me as much as the leadership is conscious. The teachers are conscious of race and they're talking about it. They're not afraid to go there. Mm. They're not afraid to unpack how they're working with it. That's important to me.
So thank you for that. And I wanted to tie this in because one of the frameworks that I found that really resonated with me and gave me a lot to really think about and reflect on in my own experience in one of the early chapters of your book, you set out this really nice table of the ways a person experiences themselves when they're in a dominant or subordinated racial group. And there was a lot on this that really spoke to me. And one aspect that I think is related to this discussion is that when you're in a dominant racial group, meaning in this case, in our history, white group, you're more allowed to focus on individual identity and to be unaware of even being in a racial group. And I also wonder if that is also related to this conversation in the sense of the Dharma in the West has often been presented as this kind of individualistic pursuit. I often joke that it's sort of sometimes borders on a form of spiritual libertarianism, you know, like it's just whatever thoughts you think, whatever karma you created, that's you and you have to work with it. And there's not any larger interdependent context for how your experience comes to be. So, but that notion of just being allowed to even have an individual identity focus and have in the next chapter, you name this as an element of white privilege to be able to choose whether or not you even are aware of being a white person as part of the privilege. So I wonder if that's part of this discussion of sort of because that's a frustration I often have trying to bring more political, especially these days, issues into Dharma spaces, that there just seems to be this overarching feeling of we're only interested in individual consciousness and individual liberation. What you name in this book is that's actually part of being part of a dominant racial group.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think that it's true. I mean, I think that there's our conditioning here in the West is the rugged individual, you know, and that's not so much the narrative or the lived experience of a lot of people of color. So when we go back to the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, in the West here, we got the Buddha, our Buddha nature, and the Dharma down pat. You know, we're getting the teachings. We understand that we can kind of wake up. But we haven't done as great a job around that third jewel, you know, what I call sometimes the bastard of the three jewels, you know, the Sangha, which is how we live together. And I know when I remember when I started teaching at Spirit Rock, the Dedicated Practitioner Program, which is a 2-year program, and I started going and teaching also in the teacher training programs with Spirit Rock and also Insight Meditation Society and part of Tara and Jeff's certification program for teachers. What you find is that the minute you start talking to your Sangha siblings or the people in your community, that's when all hell kind of breaks loose. As long as we're sitting on the cushion in our solitude, you know, or studying on our own, you know, we don't always have to engage around race and the subtlety, the nuance, the pervasiveness of it here in the West. But when we start talking to each other as a Sangha, you know, then we start getting in touch with just how the oops and the ouches and the different ways we really impact each other, that's when it comes up. This is not necessarily a problem as much as it is an opportunity. But then, you know, there's the bypassing that can happen with white folks when, which is what I've found, that there's kind of a let's move towards the ultimate reality without really feeling what's there, you know, what's there when it comes to us kind of rupturing each other through our own ignorance, our own innocence, and our own good intention to try to connect around race and racism. It's just no way we cannot rub against each other. And so I think what happens is that the privilege piece plays out when we can afford to avoid those situations. And white people can choose to not wake up to the fact that there's a collective thing called whiteness. There really is a group identity around whiteness that most white people haven't vetted. And when I say that, what I mean is most white people haven't gotten together with other white people to talk about whiteness, to talk about privilege, and to stay engaged long enough to really deepen and use the practice to investigate why is it that we find it difficult to come together to talk about race? Why does it not occur to us? What are all these other people talking about around white privilege? You know? Yeah. So that's kind of an area of investigation. So what happens, because I'm a good individual person, I'm not even a white person, I'm just a good individual person. When I look at you, I don't see color. That's kind of like the dead giveaway of why the separation will continue, right? But when white people get together to do that work with other white people, what they're doing is claiming the weight of racism by doing the work of understanding whiteness. Because when they're not doing the work of whiteness, people of color have to be in a perpetual state of pointing out what it is to them when that's something they can do on their own, right? Mm-hmm. So it's so important for white people to claim group identity, you know, because most, you know, people of color I know are not trying to be white. They're trying to be who they are. But when white people don't understand the collective impact that they have, and that they're a part of a larger soup, they may not feel dominant, they may not feel privileged, but those are feelings that one has at the individual level. The only way to understand privilege, the only way to understand dominance is to understand whiteness. Mm-hmm. And when you claim collective, it's easier to see the tattoo or the constellation at the collective level of how race and racism is really impacting the day-to-day lives of many people of color, and also many white people.
Mm. Mm. Having done a little bit of work, like earlier this year with a couple of white Dharma colleagues, Caverly Morgan and David Perrin, we hosted a day-long event and workshop for white people to work with these issues. And, it seems like a couple of things that come up in that space. One, from a well-intentioned, white person's perspective, tremendous guilt at, you know, when you really actually do start to touch what the system has been, you know, for you know, at least, you know, the history of genocide and slavery in the Western world. So that guilt can sometimes feel paralyzing. And then another element, I think, which I would love your take on, which, because I think the Dharma has a lot to say about this. Reverend Angel, I think, has expressed this beautifully as well, that being privileged in Dharma terms, you might say, like, being in the higher realms of samsara does not mean you're not suffering, you know? And that's where I see a lot of whiteness coming up, is like the guilt that comes from recognizing that you are an incredibly privileged person and yet you're still not that happy is a really, I find that to be a big experience to be faced, or barrier in the white experience, especially the privileged white experience.
Yeah. Well, what I can say a little bit, I think two things. One is guilt or shame is not a period, it's a comma. So I think what white people are challenged with when they go into that territory, and they will, it's appropriate. But it's not the end. It's the territory of deeper investigation. So it's kind of like in our mindfulness practice, something arises in the mind. If we get too tangled around it, we can't see it for what it is. You know, if we get too tangled around the guilt story, the shame story, I think it does need to be seen and felt. But I also don't think that's the end. We don't end with that story. I think there needs to be an investigation of how it lives in the body. The investigation of how shame and guilt lives in the body, in my mind, is the territory of suffering. I mean, that's when you get to feel your suffering. When you start to investigate how that shame lives, what you do with it, how it shuts you down, where it closes your heart, where it leaves you feeling groundless and all those things. So I think guilt and shame are pointers to investigate how whiteness is experienced inside the body, heart, and mind. Yeah. So we don't have to even call it privilege. We could just stay at the first foundation of mindfulness and look at the body sensations and how the breath is compromised. Or what is this feeling of numbness that kind of invades the territory when I start to have these conversations? Where do I shut down? Because if you're not invited, for white people, I find what's true is if you're not invited to investigate race, you usually just don't. Because usually what I hear from a lot of white people is when they're going to their regular meditation practice, race doesn't come up as an issue. So when you're having to read something or you're stimulated by something, like I'm suggesting in the racial affinity groups, where I have a list of questions that white people, when they come together, and all people actually, because I think everybody should be in a racial affinity group, all races. But what you get a chance to do is you keep dropping in some stimulus so that the heart and mind and body can be investigated around these issues. So guilt can come up, race, you know, rage could come up, righteousness could come up. All of that is important to give some attention to and investigate in terms of looking at our relationship to it. And I also think there's a whole series of questions we can ask about our conditioning. When did we first learn to shut down, to be silent, to be blind, to be enraged? What are those stories that have us imprisoned, and how do we loosen them through this practice to free ourselves up so there's more intimacy, more curiosity, more connection, not just with other races, but especially with our own race? What I find with white groups that attempt to come together in a racial affinity group is there's so much discomfort around being membered, around claiming the collective, right? And so sometimes guilt and shame could be a strategy to exit. But what happens when we can hold ourselves in and bring ourselves back to really feeling what it's like to be joined in a body of kind of a white collective experience, and really figure out what that is for us? So I just think there's a lot of ways we can look at the idea of privilege and look at the idea of suffering. But what's most profound is when we're investigating and we've committed ourselves to this inquiry of looking at how we've been conditioned to respond or to be touched or not by the stimulus of race and racism that's kind of immediate or indirect in our lives.
Can we talk about another big emotional response that you take on in the book is anger, which is such a complicated and multifaceted topic from a mindfulness or from a dharmic perspective. You talked about anger. You included this quote from the Dharma master, James Baldwin, where he said, "I imagine that one of the reasons that people cling to their hate and prejudice so stubbornly is because they sense that once hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with their own pain." Is there a righteous place for anger, especially around racial issues, especially around oppression or injustice? Or how does anger come into this whole conversation of working with racial injustice?
Well, I think the what we want to be most attuned to is what is the experience we're having. And of course, anger and righteousness and rage and any number of emotions can enter into the experience because it's what arises, and we're complex and we have many stories and experiences that we've had that have been traumatic and complicated and difficult. And we've witnessed things that make life hard. I mean, I think we're in a time right now politically where there's just a lot of rage going on around race and immigration issues and just this kind of what feels like a moral challenge to, you know, how we're in relationship to democracy and what it means. So there's a place for it, but here's where I like to throw. This is why I think the mindfulness piece and the Dharma is so important. When you understand that your actions, karma, your actions have impact, and that we're in the stream, our actions, our thoughts are actually planting karmic seeds, right? So what I found for myself is that I've become more sensitive to the impact of my anger and my rage and the ripple effect or the generational effect or the seeding effect that it has in the immediate situation as well as long term. So I'm not two things. I'm not quick to waste the energy of rage because sometimes I feel like it's for me to listen to and attend to, not so much to share. But also, do I want to be right or do I want to plant a seed that may bloom now or it may bloom well at some other time? So I've kind of, I've worked with rage a lot. It was my first book that I wrote on healing rage. So I see it as a sacred energy in a way, but it's really for us to work with, dance with, heal. I don't always know how effective it is if we're in reaction to it and just kind of spewing it in our lives. It's a waste of a sacred resource in a way, because I think it's here to teach us about boundaries, to teach us about our determination and our fierceness. But so it's an energy that I think we need to work with very intentionally as opposed to reactively. But of course we're going to be enraged. Of course we're going to just be at the rawness and the realness of our lived experience around race and so many other injustices. These experiences of rage are to be known. They are forms of suffering that are to be known. But they also are looking to be healed, not just be put in a situation where there could be more harm. So I'm sensitive to harm. I'm sensitive to the fact that we belong to each other, and how I show up has an impact. And I want to be more intentional about that. And I feel like I'm the best person to deal with how my rage is healed, as opposed to thinking something or someone external to me cares enough to want to take care of it better than I can. I just don't know if I buy that so much anymore. But I celebrate it. I think people need to drop it right into the heart of their practice. They need to sit on the cushion with rage. And then they need to be intentional about how it's used. It's okay to be angry and forceful around harm that's happening in the world. But can you keep the hate out of it? I think that becomes the question. Can you keep the hate out of it?
One question that's coming up for me, I don't know if you've been aware in the last few weeks, especially on social media, there's been this sort of battle between millennials and baby boomers, kind of a somewhat vitriolic battle. And there's this hashtag okay boomer, which is used by millennial people when they feel like a boomer doesn't get their experience, or, you know, when they have some anger towards baby boomers for kind of setting things up in a confused or harmful way. So just with that in mind, I wonder, are you noticing, especially with the work of mindfulness and race, are there any generational differences? Like, do you notice younger practitioners coming at this differently, or is that, does that sort of generational difference not really come up in mindfulness of race discussions or practices?
Yeah, because the training that I'm doing around mindful of race is very inwardly directed, as opposed to interpersonally or politically. You know, we're not kind of working those issues. We're really looking at our conditioning. So I'd have to say that I'm not running into that so much. I'm working with people that actually want to understand how their reactivity, their numbness, their relational field. So I'm not so much in working with people around the stories they're having as much as I'm working with people around the experiences they're having and dealing with those stories. So I'd have to say I'm not as tuned in to that kind of, you know, dynamic. I don't doubt at all that it exists, but I'm kind of working it at a different level of just looking at, you know, our relationship to whatever stimulus or activation that might be there for them. And can they be present to the issues and know their impact without, you know, causing more harm? That's where I'm hanging out.
So, yeah, I guess for our last sort of part of this discussion, that sort of notion of where does the rubber meet the road, you know, beyond, you know, reading, I think your book is really super helpful. I think it's actually really helpful for people who teach as well, in terms of pedagogical frameworks around how to sort of, you know, using, we have a lot of lists in the Dharma, which can be confining, but can also be very helpful to sort of give you some philosophical, psychological framework for how to investigate. And I think you really use those frames really well in this book, but it's different to read a book and then to sort of train in the transformative work. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about what sort of on the ground training looks like, or how you work with people.
Yeah, I think it's just really important. So what I'm doing with the Mindful of Race training program, which is really kind of an experiential engagement of the concept in the book, is I target primarily teams and organizations of people that live, have an investment long-term with each other. So I'm going in the sanghas, I'm going in sangha leadership teams, boards and staff. I'm in organizations with, I'm working with organizations that do racial justice work, where they're serving other people and they come together, but they have a life together. They're colleagues. They're working together. So my training is really targeted towards teams and organizations, and it's organized as a year-long program, which begins with a 4.5-day intensive of really looking at our conditioning and understanding the, you know, some of the principles and concepts of investigation, some of the heart practices, as well as some of the racial frameworks that keep us imprisoned because of our beliefs and traumas and things. So we do that. And then what's core to this training is the formation of racial affinity groups. And what we do over the course of the next several months is we organize the racial affinity groups within the context of the training. So people have had a foundation of language and understanding. The racial affinity groups are organized, and then they meet over the course of the next 11 months. They meet once a month. There's a framework that's structured around it. There's specific questions that they're asked around their own internal racial conditioning. And then at every 4-month periods, I come back in and work, and we combine the racial affinity groups to really look at what we've learned, what insights we've gained, you know, and we leverage the learning across race around what insights can we share that's bringing us into more awareness And then they'll go back and do another 3 months of work, and I'll come back again, and we do that for 3 times. And what we're doing over these 3 incremental times that I'm coming in is we're looking at our group development process, because we're building community as well as understanding our racial conditioning. So we're looking at how we're living together in a field of growing racial literacy and understanding of our impact. So the 3 month, the monthly activity is examining both our racial conditioning and how it lives in our group experience with each other and our work experience with each other. I work with a lot of Dharma teachers. So how is that living? So that's what the training is. And then at the end of 12 months, we have a celebration. But what happens over that period of time is people really have a slow infusion as a practice, a mindfulness practice of really looking at their conditioning, noticing how it shows up, choosing how they are in relationship to racial stimulation in their worlds and their work and their activism, having a place where they can come back and look at how they're doing, to be supported with people of their own race. And then when we come back together as a cross race group, people are really becoming more familiar with the language, the pedagogy, if you will. And they just have a way of holding each other accountable, a safe place where they can really unpack their conditioning and be embarrassed together, grow together, heal together. So that's been what the training is really all about. So that's been lovely and fruitful. Right at this time, I haven't been offering it so much as a public event, because I'm interested in the lived experience and the accountability that gets established through a racial affinity group structure, and a structure where we've learned a common framework and language to kind of hold ourselves and each other accountable. But a public event could become possible. It's just not where I think the juice of this training is right now.
It sounds so in depth, and I love the sort of balance of the affinity groups working on their own and then coming back together. And that sort of feels like there's a kind of relative ultimate truth balance.
That's right.
In there.
Yeah.
Do you find that people are willing to, I mean, obviously, you know, there's this whole notion of McMindfulness and people only, you know, superficially committing to sort of being present, and then there's this notion that the Dharma you really have to deepen and commit. So I find those longer trainings to be more fruitful, but it's also harder to get people to really stick through. Do you find that people really commit to that length of training period?
Well, I think that, you know, it's just such a journey. I only go where I'm invited. So the idea is that when people come to the training, they're coming because they're choosing. And it's important that they know what they're signing up for. So they're signing up for a year-long commitment. So people come in kind of knowing that. But again, in the innocence and ignorance arena, I've had racial affinity groups come together, and they've met diligently each month, but they haven't done the question. They haven't answered the questions with each other. It's turned into a social group, or they might go to a museum, or they might read a book, and all of that's fine, but it's just not the racial affinity group work that I'm proposing, right? So the proposal is that you are looking at and answering these questions around your racial conditioning. So what I've seen is some people just totally bypass that and go into a whole nother arena that's external for them. And just like it is when we sit on the cushion and we bring our minds back again and again and again, when you're in these racial affinity groups, you bring yourself back to them again and again. Most people follow the agenda, I must say, but some people are really in the struggle of how to stay in the territory of this internal investigation, especially white people. But I've also seen it with people of color groups where they come together and they want to talk about what's wrong as opposed to looking at the questions of our conditioning and how we rewire and heal them. So there is an element of this that I've come to expect. Of course, people are going to wander away. And can we come back and recommit? So these racial affinity groups structured, the idea is that the groups are small, they're well held, you know, people get some good airtime and attention. And there's a lot of instruction in the book and also in this training where that gets set up very intentionally, because we need consent when we're in this kind of process.
Well, I think that's a great place to end. So Ruth King, Dharma teacher and coach and author of most recently Mindful of Race, I just want to thank you so much for being on the Road Home podcast, and hope you'll come back sometime.
Thank you so much, Ethan. I've enjoyed it.
So for the Road Home, this is Ethan Nickturn, and we'll see you next time. Thanks so much.
What does cultivating stress resilience look like? Join Dan Siegel and Alyssa Epple for a September 20th through 22nd workshop designed to renew caregiving professionals. Learn more at 1440.org/beherenow.